Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Lonnie Jarrett here, and I'm here with my friend, Amy Edelstein.
Good evening, everyone.
So we're really glad that you could join us tonight for this call. The call is being offered as part of a yearly fundraiser for Enlighten Next, which is an international organization committed to bringing the values of evolutionary enlightenment into consciousness and culture. The organization is founded on the spiritual teachings of Andrew Cohen, and Amy has been a student of Andrew's for 26 years, and I've been with Andrew for 10. And this fundraiser is very interesting. It takes the form of a meditation marathon. So every year we push ourselves further in terms of what we can do with meditation. And on December 8th until midnight on December 9th, we'll be meditating for 24 hours straight. Some of us will be doing 48 hours. Some of us will be doing 24 hours. And then as soon as the 24 hours of meditation is done, getting up and running actual real marathons or 12 miles or doing other creative works. And we do the meditation marathon to take a stand for realizing emptiness and the prioritization of spirit as foundations for living and finding creative solutions to the challenges that face us in the contemporary world. We meditate to introduce ourselves to the dimensions of ourselves, just beyond the mind, beyond the personality, beyond what we call ego. Those participating in the call tonight may choose to support Amy and all of our efforts, either financially or by participating in the marathon with us and actually joining us for all or part of the time that we'll be meditating. Immediately after the call, you'll receive an email with links to pages that will enable you either to contribute or to participate in the marathon. So just to say a little bit about Amy, again, she's been a student, close student of Andrew Cohen's for 26 years. She's a founding member of the Enlighten Next organization and wrote five on the editorial staff and as a journalist for Enlighten Next magazine, which was the later incarnation of What is Enlightenment, an award-winning magazine on spirituality and cultural transformation. So, welcome, Amy. Thanks for joining tonight.
Thank you, Lonnie. Thank you for that detailed introduction for why we're doing this call. Lonnie, obviously, as everyone knows, is a expert teacher and practitioner of Chinese medicine. And the reason why we thought to speak together tonight is because I had a very powerful experience about 2.5 years ago, which demonstrated the importance of sustained and ongoing and committed spiritual practice and spiritual inquiry. I was in a terrible auto accident, a head-on collision with an 18-wheel tractor trailer. And there were the power of my own sustained practice and the commitment over many years, 26 years practicing evolutionary enlightenment and another 4 or 5 years before that of meditation and spiritual practice, gave me a deeper ground that helped keep me, it helped stabilize me and provide a context for dealing with that kind of physical challenge in a way that was very unusual. And that's partly what we're going to speak about tonight. That's partly why we wanted to do this call. The fundraiser that Enlighten Next is doing is supports, as Lonnie explained, the value of spirit that we want and I want through my own life and example and also through my teaching work to inspire as many people as possible to engage with the deeper dimensions of life and to inquire and explore consciousness absolute and to discover what it means to find a deeper meaning and purpose and direction for one's life. So that's really why Lonnie and I are here together, and I'm looking forward to speaking with him and with all of you. We'll take questions towards the end of the call, so please do stay on and take note of your questions along the way, and you'll have time to put them to myself or Lonnie, and we'll be happy to answer them.
Fantastic, Amy. So I know some people that I had forwarded to everybody who registered for this, your fundraising page where you described your accident, and you had pictures up there. And it's really remarkable to me that you were involved in this terrible accident. You sustained critical injuries. But sitting here with you, you're completely vibrating. I'm fine. You're completely vibrant. You're communicating a deep sense of health. And you're totally engaged in a life committed to working for the advancement of culture. And you've taken this really remarkable stand in the face of your accident and the ongoing effects that it's had in your life. And it's just really inspiring. So let's, I'd like to just start with some questions about that and the stand that you took. So from my perspective, I've been in Chinese medicine for 33 years. I've been practicing full-time for 27. And so much of clinical practice in popular culture involves making slight adjustments to patients' feeling and emotional states for the sake of providing comfort. Oftentimes, comfort is really the antithesis of evolution. And it's my goal with patients as treatment progresses to help them increasingly embrace an unvictimized perspective on their experience. In fact, I know a patient is getting better at a deep level, at a spirit level, at a soul level, that I'm really getting to the core of them when they start expressing more and more positivity about their life, given any circumstances in their life, and they're expressing relatively less victimization over time. And you really made a choice in the moment of the accident to just take an unvictimized position from the very start. To me, this would be clinical heaven. If I walked in every day and practiced with patients who weren't victims, medicine would just be about evolution, right? Taking care of the body, and as a vehicle for the evolution of consciousness. So I'm wondering if you can speak for a while about the pursuits in your own life that laid the foundation for taking such a radical stand. And I'm particularly interested in any elaboration you can give us on the role that meditation has played.
That's a great question. And I don't know what it would do for the treatment room, obviously, but for everyone who's listening to this webcast, obviously, all of you in one way or another take some interest in health, healing, and a context for health and healing and for facing challenges of life that's deeper and broader. And that's really what I can speak to. I'm not a medical practitioner, and I know that individuals face all kinds of challenging situations that where the physical also affects the emotional, and some of it's chemical and some of it's not. So I don't want to cross lines, or speak beyond what I am qualified to speak to. But what I can speak to is certainly my own experience, where in the midst of this situation, where I really didn't have. I wasn't sure what my future was going to be, and I wasn't sure how injured I was, and I wasn't sure whether those were my last moments of consciousness or my last moments of lucid consciousness, because I just simply didn't know how deep the injuries might go. And at that moment, I was very aware of a ground or a presence of unified consciousness. And I recognized that I had a choice to let go in a negative sense into my own terror, pain, fear of the future and fear of the present, or let go into a deeper and higher truth that I knew from my years of spiritual practice. And one was offering unity, positivity, love, and the other was offering fragmentation, isolation, and separation, and more fear. And I recognized two things. One was there were about 30 people trying to help extricate me from the tangled mass of metal that I was trapped in, and I felt that I didn't really have any right to check out on the life process when so many people were so concerned and caring so much and paying such close attention. I felt I didn't have a right to separate myself from that and indulge in a kind of hysteria. And the other was, I thought, if this is really going to be my last moment of coherence, I haven't lived a life dedicated to spiritual transformation to not express that at the end. And that, I think, is what I can really speak to on to everyone who has the opportunity to listen to this, is that we really want to do our spiritual practice so that in the moments that really count, we're so familiar with what we care about most. We're so familiar with that which really moves us at a deeper level. We're so familiar with that spiritual impulse that calls us to go beyond our own limits and calls us to step beyond our own fears and calls us to strive to be much deeper human beings than we necessarily think we're capable of. And when we're familiar enough with that, through ongoing practice and through spiritual comradeship with our friends and through, you know, daily trials, then in moments like this, that is the more familiar touchstone to us. And then we're able to express, we're able to choose for that in a moment of, you know, where we could go either way and where the choice is really, really up to our own will and our decision about our own destiny. And that has a benefit for ourselves and, you know, potentially for our health. We don't have control over all the physical aspects of our life, but it potentially can really help us physically. But if not, it's going to help everyone around us and us spiritually be an expression of something that's noble, that has to do with the nobility of human spirit. And that's ultimately what I think we're here for.
That's fantastic, Amy. What it brings to mind is that when I was about 14, I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I didn't understand any of it, because obviously it's a complex book that to understand you have to take initiation and be in a lineage. But I got one thing out of it, which was very relieving, which is when you die, go toward the white light. And my takeaway message was, okay, absolutely no problem, I'll remember that. And of course, many years later, I realized that, well, probably at that moment, I'll keep doing exactly what I've been doing my whole life for the exact same motivation. And really that, you know, we like to imagine ourselves as making the noble choice. But it's not enough to imagine. We don't want to take it for granted. And spiritual practice really lays a foundation so that in those critical moments, we have this other dimension of ourselves that opens up to us, but that we recognize because we're familiar with it, because we've been giving to it. And it throws the weight in our favor to make the right choice and go in the right direction. Do you want to say anything specifically about meditation in this regard and the discovery of that timeless, formless dimension beyond the mind, the ground of being, and your realization of that and how that plays into all this? You were a very serious meditator in caves in India, right?
I meditated quite a bit. I started meditating when I was in my late teens, and I was not a very good meditator. So anyone on this webcast who doesn't think they're a very good meditator, I would encourage you to stick with it, because I could sit still, but I was tormented by my mind constantly, and I didn't really know how to go beyond it. I had experiences of going beyond the mind, but I kept paying attention to my mind anyway. I did a lot of long meditation retreats. I did a 3-month retreat, and I've had more or less a daily spiritual practice for the last 26 years, give or take. Meditation does two things, as you said, Lonnie. One of the things it does is it really allows us to let go of the temporal world. It allows us to let go of that which happens in time and space, that which is defined by what we know and can see and taste and smell and touch and what we think and our problems, the world's problems. And it lets us telescope out so that, you know, what's the biggest problems that are consuming our day, which may be very valid, it's like looking at the night sky. You know, if you get a telescope and you look at the face of the moon, it can take up the whole lens. But if you telescope back out, it just becomes a little dot in the night sky, and there are billions of other stars out there. And that's what meditation lets us do. It lets us telescope back from all of that and become more aware of that space that is limitless, that black sky behind the stars that has no beginning, has no end, wasn't born, was unaffected by anything that occurred within it. And when we discover that, we discover a part of ourselves that's always there, that's closer than close, that's more us than anything else, that we didn't know about before, but once we discover it, we realize we somehow always knew, we're never separate from it. And it gives us access to an experience of the truth of the goodness of life. And that's undeniable, and it's something nobody can take away from us. And that's what meditation is. It's a portal or a doorway to the infinite, what you said, the unborn, the deathless, and that's something that then, you know, is a ground for us and a touchstone. And the other thing that meditation does for us is it just gets us to practice. You know, it's like playing the piano, or Lonnie, I know you play the guitar. You practice, and the more you practice, the more your muscles get used to hitting the right notes and playing the right chords, and they get better and better. And so meditation is the same way. We exercise our spiritual muscles. So in relationship to the torment of our mind, we're able to assume a right relationship to it and know what to pay attention to and what to ignore. And that's very important, particularly in this day and age where most of us are so tormented by our feelings and our thoughts and our worries. We need to practice an access to depth.
Mm-hmm. And in the, one can have an experience really looking at the eyes through that timeless and formless ground onto the universe, where the whole universe drops away, and the body and even thoughts, feelings, emotions, but the physical body are revealed to just be objects in awareness. And if you really look through the eyes of emptiness onto creation, which includes our thoughts, feelings, emotions, and onto our own body, one can actually disidentify with them for a moment or even an extended period. If you read Ramana Maharshi, other Indian saints, there was a complete disidentification with the body to the point they would just starve to death meditating in a cave if the townspeople didn't come and feed them, right? The little kids would come and throw rocks at them to see if they could make them move. So as an ultimate position, and as a spiritual experience, there's this disidentification with the body, and yet trauma, suffering, fear, doubt come into the mind, especially in the face of having an accident like this, feeling tremendous pain. There's nothing like pain to make us start looking through the wrong end of that telescope very quickly, and have the moon and the whole universe disappear and have just one little problem, one little sensation become our whole sphere of reference. So you made this choice in the heat of the moment, but more than that, you've stood by it. And I'm just wondering, on a daily level, when you feel pain or if uncertainty arises, how is it that you don't let that small contraction of ego pull you back to the personal, and you keep maintaining the bigger perspective?
It's a good question, and I have a lot to say about it, but to be totally honest, I'm not so sure why. From that moment that I made that very, very conscious choice, I haven't really struggled with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 2.5 years. I've been through 3 surgeries. I spent about 3 months pretty much bedridden. I really didn't struggle with a sense of victimization or self-pity from that moment on. And I can't completely tell you why. It was a very deep decision that I was not going to waste any time of my precious life doing that. I just was not going to do it. It was not worth it. It was going to have such negative consequences that I just absolutely was not going to do it. And I guess when you make a decision like that at a certain level of your being, you close any option. And so I haven't really struggled. It's not like I go through where I need to give myself a mantra of remember what I did, remember right. what I decided. I just haven't done that. Other people may have different experience and may need to reaffirm and recommit. And there's nothing wrong with that. So long as we do it, it doesn't really matter. And we will get challenged in different ways. One of the things that the decision did give me was it did give me a kind of ease and curiosity about my own condition, where I didn't deal too much with the future, what the consequences were going to be, because I didn't really know. But I was able to work with pain in interesting ways. So meditation gives you access to a ground beyond time and form. But what I was able to do, I think partly because of that, was to have some freedom around tremendous pain and do a lot with visualization, do a lot with paying attention to the body and being able to work around physical pain in very interesting ways. So I think part of what that kind of spaciousness gives is it gives us a kind of scientific curiosity that isn't that goal-oriented, but you're willing to just be responsible for your own condition, engage with it, not be too obsessed by it, but also be a little bit more free to work with it in different ways. Now, I had an unbelievably excellent medical team, from surgeon to visiting nurses at home to physical therapists to osteopaths. So I had such superb people helping me. So that's obviously a big part of the picture. If you have good people, that it makes a world of difference. But ultimately, we need to be proactive in relationship to our own bodies, even in relationship to illnesses that can't be diagnosed, that you don't know what the prognosis is, and be interested and positive about the experience of life and the experience of living, the phenomena of pain, the wonder of healing, and all of that, and engage with it in a certain way, be active in it.
That's fantastic. I mean, one of the things I hear and what comes through just looking at you and speaking with you is this absolute conviction in the positivity of life. And that conviction came from spiritual practice prior to the accident. But in that moment, you know, in a moment like that, one can either care more or care less. One can go, as you said, there's sort of a gate. One can go one way, which is into that sort of hellish contraction of self-concern. But there's also another choice, and you are familiar with the nature of that, and just had the complete conviction to make it, and you haven't moved from it. And you know, as another human being with a body, who faces health issues. It's totally inspirational. And as a medical practitioner, again, it would just be clinical heaven to be working at that level. And a significant part of my own teaching, really the sole thing that I'm working for, is to try to create a culture where these are the shared cultural assumptions between all of us, so that when something like this occurred, everyone on the medical staff and the patient would be unified in this conviction and in this orientation, this non-victimized orientation, and this confidence in the positivity of life and the felt responsibility to each other going forward in something bigger. Yeah.
Well, that would certainly be heaven. I got an email from a colleague and friend who is facing a terrible cancer, and she has an integral background and is very interested in health and healing and relationship to it. And she wrote a beautiful, moving piece about how she wished that her medical practitioners could share that kind of positivity and context for life. Now, obviously, we don't necessarily have that luxury. Certainly my medical practitioners don't share it at all. My surgeon's a quintessential surgeon, and all the stereotypes that surround it. But there's a way that if we're deeply rooted in that spiritual context ourselves, then we don't need to expect that of those around us who don't share that, but who have skills to offer to us in that kind of situation. And I think, again, that's part of deep meditation practice. What it gives you, it gives all of us that experience of the unified self, absolute, that one without a second. And we recognize that we aren't separate from anyone, and we never could be, and that we don't need to expect those around us to share the same outlook if, you know, we're able to work together and they have skills to offer. Now, obviously, everyone needs to choose their health practitioners wisely and make sure they're qualified and that they have resonance with them and they trust them. But in terms of our own spiritual foundation, so long as we are deeply nourished by that eternal well, we don't necessarily need the nurses and surgeons to provide that for us. And there is a way that we can connect and respect and share a kind of joy and love for wholeness, health, and healing that without needing to speak about these things.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I mean, in the New Age healing arts, and I'm going to include Chinese medicine in that, I mean, granted, Chinese medicine's 4,000 years old, but it came to this country in 1972, and the entire culture in the West of Chinese medicine is just very influenced by postmodernism and came of age, you know, during the age of Aquarius, right along with Reiki and everything else as the Dharma came from the East to the West. And there's such a conflation of this humanistic psychological perspective with spirituality. Many people who, they write books on the spiritual practice of medicine, you listen to lectures on it, I read articles on it, and virtually to a person, everyone's really talking about a psychological perspective, not a very relativistic perspective. What I can call, maybe in my more cynical moments, is decorating the prison cell. And, you know, using holistic healing to provide a little more psychological comfort for people. We spend a lot of time processing emotions with people. And it just occurs to me that if patients were taking such a liberated view in relationship to their own healing and so much responsibility for it, I wouldn't have to attend to any of that. We wouldn't have to take time to any of that. And what I'd be doing as a holistic healer would be doing what we're supposed to be doing, which is actually healing the body, purifying the vehicle, because consciousness would already be moving through it.
I mean, I would agree. And at the same time, if individuals need to become more aware of their psychological relationship to their illness, to the people around them, to life itself, then that does need to be done. Again, that's part of why we do spiritual practice, and a deep and abiding commitment to spiritual practice and spiritual transformation. We will face our psychological selves. We won't be able to bypass them.
Right.
But if we're committed to doing that work throughout our lives, then illness isn't going to be anything outside that. So long as we're committed to this kind of deep transformation of self and alignment of our own value set to a higher and deeper value set, a value set defined by our deepest spiritual experience, what we've discovered about that one without a second, what we've discovered about the fact that we live in an evolving universe and that we're human beings who are conscious of our own self-sense and therefore can evolve our own self-sense. If we're committed to that in a deep way, then we will be facing a tremendous amount about our psychological selves and our own shadows and blocks and irrational fears and negativity, and we'll be working through that. So if we become ill or have an accident or an injury along the way, it won't be fundamentally different than how we're dealing with ourselves at any other point in our lives. So part of what I feel ongoing spiritual practice does is it keeps us, it gives us an even keel, so that then, you know, we don't check out of life just because we had a car accident, or we don't check out of life because we find out we have some terrible terminal illness. We're able to continue along facing, transforming, and aligning ourselves more fully to our highest aspirations. And that's what spiritual practice does.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic, Amy. You know, while you were talking, one of the things that occurred to me was so much of the suffering that I see in my own clinic, in my medical practice, is that most people are under the illusion that what they're experiencing is personal, right? So there's this sense of isolation, of going through something very unique and very, very personal. The other day I was talking to an elderly gentleman who I'm close to, who I've treated for a number of years, whose wife is fairly sick. They're, you know, reasonably at the end of their lives together. And this is something he's been facing for quite a while, and I've been treating him through this situation. And I looked at him and I said, well, you know, as bad as this is, I have to tell you, it's really just average. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, any two people who spend 40, 50 years together, one of them is going to be facing this. And there was something in the moment of him realizing, just thinking for the first time and seeing it in a completely impersonal way, which sort of diffused all the tension and sense of suffocating in it. And there was so much lightness in the room after that. And I just imagine that your spiritual practice, because spirit in a way could be looked at that which is impersonal, that dimension of the self that we all share together, that your spiritual practice had opened up you, had helped open you up to an impersonal view of your own situation, and even in the heat of the moment and ongoing, it must just help to be able to see everything in that way.
Definitely, because I think partly what the ongoing spiritual practice does is it helps us constantly connect with the purpose of our lives. And certainly that's what helped me maintain a certain kind of stability throughout the challenges and ongoing challenges that I continue to face, because there's a higher purpose. And And part of that is seeing the impersonality of human life and not avoiding human life and not feeling particularly special, particularly victimized, particularly hard done by. You know, as you know, one of the Buddha's first insights was that there was suffering, old age, and death. And of course, postmodern individuals, and if you're, you know, our age, you start to see your parents are aging, and you start to enter into a different life phase where our own mortality comes back into view, and where it might have gone out of view for a while we were living in the illusion of eternal youth. But so I think that's part of being aware of our surroundings, and part of being kind of less infatuated with our own emotional or psychological experience, and just more scientists of the life process, and more just inclusive of the life process. I think another part of it is the context that I practice spirituality is an evolutionary context. So I'm aware of a 13 and a half or a little more billion year trajectory of how the universe came into being. So the fact that my own life or the people around me go through illness, death, physical challenges is really kind of nothing when you look at the burst of stars that formed, you know, gases that cohered together into compounds that eventually cohered into different life forms, and, you know, billions and billions of generations. So you start to see yourself as part of a much bigger life process that's much less personal, much less concerned with your own particular ups and downs, and you are able to take a more scientific approach that's not cold or unemotional. There's just simply more space to it all.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and it's very radical to actually approach the circumstances of your own life with interest, as opposed to being completely embedded within those circumstances and always reacting in some habitual way to them and trying to solve some problem. Being able to step back, even in the face of physical pain or an illness, and just to be able to be interested in the process. I mean, after all, I mean, what we're talking about is your life or my life. That is our life, as opposed to dissociating from it, denying that it's one's life, trying to make it in some other way, trying to change it, of course. I mean, we're trying to change it. We want to get better. We want to heal. But none of that has to deny really being present with the process in the moment and looking at it in a more objective way from a distance, having more space around the experience.
Well, it's interesting. There were two things I was thinking as you were speaking. And first of all, the opposite doesn't help. So if we just want to be very straightforward and rational about it, having a negative relationship, a fearful relationship, a victimized relationship, a worrisome relationship to our physical health and well-being simply doesn't help. It is so profoundly not useful in about a million different ways that if you really just recognize that, you say, oh, okay, you know, I am really tempted to worry, but it really is not going to help. It's absolutely, if I run through that scenario and what might happen in a year, 2 years, 5 years, it's absolutely going to get me nowhere except more frightened and more depressed. Mm-hmm. So that's one part. I mean, that's just a very straightforward, not particularly profound, but absolutely useful perspective on it all. It just really doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot what else I was going to say. What were you saying before this?
I don't know. I was paying so much attention to what you were saying. But when you were just speaking, what came up for me is, look, I mean, not only doesn't it help, but really we have to do everything we can possibly do. And that's the most we can do to help our situation, and the outcome's going to be whatever it's going to be. And, you know, we're both in our 50s, and we've lived long enough to know, in the first place, that virtually across the board, the worst we ever thought was going to happen didn't. Right? And, you know, we can look back in our lives, and I know I would just say, if I could change one thing, I never should have worried about any of the things I worried about, because the things that actually got me were the things I never saw coming, not any of the things that I worried about. And it just leads me into my next point, which is, I'm, you know, my estimation would be that the ego usurps about 99% of our physiological resources to create and maintain the illusion that who we are is a separate individual, that individual that was born in time, given a name, has 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years of life experience. And the ego takes 99% of our energy to screen all the other dimensions of self out of consciousness. So all we know ourselves as is our emotions, our thoughts, and our feelings related to our stored memories that create this artificial self. And in my experiences, in the first experience I ever had of non-dual consciousness, my first significant spiritual awakening, it just hit me like a lightning bolt. And I had not been able to really breathe well for years. And for a week, I felt like I was on top of a mountain, like breathing very refined air. And it just hit me that 99% of our energy is taken to create this illusion. And I'm just wondering what your experience is, given the stand that you've taken and the conscious choice you made to shift your perspective and to hold your perspective where it has been. What's your experience of that freeing resources for healing and making just the whole experience lighter, easier?
There are two parts of that question. One has to do with the relationship to ego. And for those who are listening, I wasn't always like this. So I wasn't always this positive. I didn't always have this kind of relationship to life. And again, you know, that's what committed spiritual practice does. We aren't all necessarily gifted with a kind of profound purity of motive and alignment with our higher spiritual intentions. Most of us, like myself, really have to clock the hours. We have to put time into transcending our own limitations and transcending our own fear and being willing to hold our breath, you know, when the separate self is screaming for attention, and allow ourselves to make a different choice. And that takes a kind of spiritual practice and commitment that is not something that we're really taught to do or value. I mean, we'll work hard if we go to Princeton and want to, you know, do well on get our PhD, but we won't necessarily make that same kind of effort for our own transformation and our own ability to go beyond the clamors of the separate sense of self. And that is something that we all need to take quite seriously, because if we really do want to live ennobling and noble lives, we do have to wrestle with our own limitation and our own emotional limitation and spiritual limitation in order to really choose something different than what we were habituated to choosing. So that was a process where, before the accident, was something that I had already put 20-some years into and had really worked on transforming my relationship to life through practice, through meditation, through inquiry, through engagement with like-minded people, through philosophical inquiry. And if we're committed to doing that we're going to get buoyed by an inspiration that comes from our own transformation. When we start to transform from the inside out and we're doing it ourselves through our own practice, through our own engagement. It's not just some, you know, blaster experience that we have in meditation. It's through our own effort. It gives you such tremendous joy, such tremendous energy and inspiration and desire to do more. It's a kind of a self-generating momentum. And that's the kind of thing that nobody can do for us. And as we commit at that level and put the time into and keep our sights high, we're capable of so much more than we think we are. Now, how much resource and energy that frees for the physical healing process, hard to say. But it's going to make us happier and better and more inspiring and more inspired human beings. So whether that's going to cure us of some, you know, terrible disease that we may contract, maybe, maybe not. I mean, I wouldn't want to venture to say that. But will it make us live a more purposeful life in the midst of it? Definitely, yes. And that's what we have control over.
Yeah. You know, ultimately, we cultivate virtue for the sake of virtue. I mean, we're guaranteed that if we don't move from having integrity and we cultivate integrity, we're guaranteed integrity, but nothing else. But nonetheless, not being on antidepressants has definitely helped your physiology, right? There's a sense of positivity, that life force. I mean, again, just sitting with you, and I'm sure everyone can hear it in your voice, I have no doubt as a practitioner that life force that you're expressing is the only source of healing. I know as an acupuncturist and an herbalist that that's the only force that I can work with in a person, and that acupuncture, just using needles, that's the only force it works with. There is no other force. All it can do is, to a degree, one degree or another, is liberate that in a person, in the body and in their own awareness, to give them experience of an original self, a deeper self than their common, than the ego that they're commonly relating to. And then it's my responsibility to help contextualize that experience for them so they find obligation in it and over time learn how to generate that more so it becomes conscious and they're not dependent on what I'm doing.
Part of what this kind of inquiry does is it helps us remain conscious. You brought up antidepressants, and we may have to take all kinds of medications that affect our psychology and that affect our consciousness and affect our experience. I've certainly had to do that from medications for the brain injury from the car accident to painkillers from surgery, and you do get affected on an emotional, psychological, physiological level. There is a way of staying aware and not opting out, because part of what's tempting to do with ongoing chronic pain, ongoing, you know, physical challenge, is to just want out, to want to tune out, to want to veg out. And that's never going to be sustaining spiritually, probably not sustaining physically either. And it's not to say that we don't sleep or we don't take painkillers, but there is a way of staying conscious of experience. And there was one period where I was on 3 months of medication for brain injury, and the day I used to have to watch my experience, and every day I would wake up profoundly depressed, like I would see the world through this veil of fog and negativity. But I knew it was the medication. I could tell it was a physiological emotional experience I was having. I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't change it. I didn't necessarily assume that that was me or that there was anything I needed to do about it to make it eventually, you know, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it would kind of fade out. And the day after I came off that medication, my spiritual teacher, who I work quite closely with, said, "Wow, your consciousness seems totally different today." I said, "Oh yeah, I came off the medication." So we do get affected by these things, but it doesn't need to change our awareness, our relationship to life, or to tempt us or convince us to take something as real, which is simply a physiological experience that we don't really have any control over.
Yes, and I think that's so important because so often people really do personalize what they're feeling, and they assume because they're feeling it that it's them because they're identified with that. But so much of what we experience, especially pain after an accident or the side effects of drugs, really isn't us at all. It's happening in our awareness, but meditation and spiritual practice open us to a dimension which is actually fine. It actually doesn't have a problem. And I think it's just so important for us to be looking at the challenges and the difficulties that are going on from that perspective. From that perspective. And there's one other, I only have one last question, and then I think we're going to open this up for everybody else online. So it's been my experience clinically that the degree to, and also in my own life, that the degree to which I or the degree to which a patient genuinely cares for something bigger than themselves is the degree to which really one is able to maintain objectivity in the face of the experience. And before you were talking about the process of universal development, and that would be the biggest thing one cares for. I mean, clinically, with patients, I try to get them motivated by trying to awaken their conscience, to extend their care to their immediate family. And then the bigger picture, but I get the sense with you, I mean, and I certainly feel it too in my life, of this, we have this obligation to something just much bigger than ourselves. I'm not finding the strength to take this position for myself. It's because I see it as a debt owed to you, to my family, to my students, to my patients. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that in your own experience, because you've certainly expressed it here, the sense of feeling an obligation, feeling responsible to something much bigger than just how do you feel in the moment.
I really think that's the only way to weather profound challenges in life, is to have a purpose that we know is greater than our own experience, and that we really believe in, that we deeply care about, that we feel intimately connected to, and that we want our life to stand for. Most of us just wouldn't be very heroic if it's just between us and us.
Right.
And generally, it takes a much bigger purpose than even just the ones we care about. And particularly with chronic pain and ongoing illness and, you know, extended periods of physical disability, one of the challenges that many people face is not taking those around them for granted, not losing a sense of gratitude and respect and space for those who have extended themselves with love, with care, with practical support. And part of what enables us to do that is wanting to live a noble human life, wanting to live a spiritual life, wanting to be an expression of a higher possibility. Because if we just want to be patient with our spouses or our parents or our loved ones, we won't really find it within us to do that. We really have to recognize an obligation to a higher context and allow that higher context to exert a pressure on us to conform to it. We can't conform to it. It's going to force us to conform to it. And that really is the only way around, because we all have human foibles and we all get frustrated and irritated and discouraged and depressed, and that's human. It's part of the range of human emotion. We want to be aware of that. We don't want to become automatons, but we want to be uplifted by something much greater than the weather report of the day.
Right. Well, beautifully said. We're going to open the call up now to any of you who have questions for Amy or myself. And to do that, you just have to push 1 on your keyboard, and we'll take as many questions as we have time for. The call is going until 1:15. So please just press 1 and your phone will be unmuted and you can speak to us.
Great, so we've got Catherine on the line. Catherine, we'll unmute you.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Lonnie. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi. So this is really more of a contemplation than a question. What really struck me, especially in reading your essay, which was quite beautiful and moving, and this is something that I contemplate a lot just in the context of you know, the work I do with Lonnie, is that this perspective is not something that can be, it can't be faked, and it can't be, it's not, you know, an intellectual understanding, that it's really something that has to come from an experiential understanding of something much deeper. And it's very, very inspiring to read your account, because it reminds me once again that I have to keep, I just have to keep going forward. I have to keep doing this work so that I can be the kind of healthcare practitioner and, you know, really the kind of person that I want to be. So thank you so much for the inspiration.
You're welcome. I mean, it's exactly as you said, because we can't fake our own understanding. At the same time, we have to just keep practicing, and we have to act as if, and we have to go through years and years and years of, in spite of how we feel and in spite of where we think we are, that we're going to respond to something greater. And we're not going to assume that means anything about us. We're not going to assume it means where we are or where we aren't, or whether we're deep people or shallow people or full of ego or not full of ego. We're just going to keep responding to what we've recognized to be a bigger context and aspire to align our lives according to that and make that our own. That's the best we can do. Our internal gauge of how evolved we are is not very useful. My emotional experience may not be that different than you. It's just what I choose to pay attention to.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think the developmental aspect that Amy's pointing to is so important too. Because it's not just a question of, meditating and discovering this emptiness and then sort of dissociating in that place. There's this sort of relentless positivity, this life force, which really is the source of healing. And one of the main functions of that life force is this push to just keep going forward, to not stop anywhere and to just keep evolving. And we need to be vehicles for that. Not just, I don't get a sense listening to Amy that she made a choice and she's resting. It's an ongoing development, right? Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you, Catherine. Terry, we're unmuting your line. And
hey, Amy.
Hi, Terry.
Thank you so much. This has really been very inspiring. And what has been so, what really struck me is when you talked about the proactive, you know, and oftentimes in the treatment room, we are working with individuals that are in pain and all they want to do is get out of pain. And so this whole idea of this being proactive and just what you were talking about with Catherine, this positivity and this leaning in and being interested in the healing process, I feel can be so valuable in working with, you know, people that are in this type of pain, and the whole notion of this, you know, just the threat that this is just an ongoing part of life, and you know, living a noble life is how you are going to go through this process.
That's right. I mean, my experience with pain is to not spend too much time thinking about it. That's a tricky one, because the more, you know, unless you're actively doing some kinds of visualizations that help move pain around and dissipate it, which is entirely possible. And I used to practice that several times a day, every day. But pain's a tough one, because it really does cloud the consciousness. And generally, in my experience, being distracted by something more important is the best remedy for pain.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Terry. So I'm going to call on Andrea. Andrea, fantastic to talk to you at last.
Thank you. Thank you both, Amy, also, for sharing your story. I have been in a car accident about the same time as you. And in the accident, I walked away without any visible injuries, but 10 days later couldn't move from the base of my skull to my tailbone, and I'm still looking through that. But the core of my struggle has more to do with the fact that somebody died. That's what I was involved in. And although I was...
Excuse me one second, Andrea. It's very hard to hear you, so I don't know if you have... if you're on Skype and can put headphones in and speak into a mic, that might be better, because if you have your speaking with the speakers on, it's a little hard to hear. I followed the first couple sentences, but then I couldn't understand.
Okay, I'm actually on a cell phone.
On a cell phone. Do you have okay. If you take it off speaker, it might be better.
Yeah, can you take it off speaker?
Yes, is that better?
Yeah, that's
better. Perfect.
Okay, good. So I was in a car accident myself 2.5 years ago in which someone died. And it was not someone I knew, but without being casual or grandiose about saying what happened, I will say I ran over somebody and he died. And he initially struck another vehicle and was tossed in my path before I ran over him. One of the things that I'm struggling with is trying to find any way at all to feel noble about this, because it just, nothing in it feels noble to me. There was a moment where I was aware that I could not get out of this man's way fast enough, and I knew that he was more vulnerable than I was and that he was about to suffer some serious consequence. And I remember praying for him in that moment. And as if I could have a telepathic communication with him to say, I really don't want to be doing this to you, but here we go with all the compassion I can muster. And at that moment, I was fine. In that moment, I had no fear. In that moment, I was filled with love. And since then, I've been struggling. So is there anything that you can say to speak to that?
Wow, well, that's a tough one. That's obviously very tough. And it sounds like, you know, there's some things that happen to us or that we do in our lives that may be with us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And the most that we can do is really transform at a deeper level so that the rest of our lives are really giving back, not just with charity, but with our own transformation and higher values. And you know, because I wouldn't, I mean, that's obviously a very painful and difficult situation that you went through. And we may not be able to be be beyond, you know, our regret and remorse. And the best we can do is really live a life that matters and that means something and that makes a mark and that's a gift to humanity. And that would be your way of giving back and honoring.
Mm-hmm. It also strikes me, Andrea, that you had said that the situation didn't feel noble to you, but I think what Amy's pointing to is that the nobility emerges in the response. The situation is just what the situation was, and, you know, we can superstitiously say, well, everything happens for a meaning, but some things just happen, and I think every moment of life, you know, at least the moments that really matter are these critical moments like Amy had, where a person can go one way or another, and the nobility emerges in your response to what happened.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
Does anybody else have a question? Anyone else? I see some of my students on there who don't ask questions when they're sitting in class with me. I always tell them it's like looking at Mount Rushmore. Mark LeWinter. How are you, Mark?
Doing great. Doing great. It's been
fantastic
great
to have you here.
Excellent. Glad to be here. I just wanted to thank you, Amy, for sharing what you have in regards to your story. And I become aware of the fact that the things that that you're pointing us to and the potentials that we can achieve can't happen independent of ourselves. And I think that, you know, you said this in some ways, but I see this more and more in how we depend on each other to pull ourselves to this higher level. So, in that way, we need to have the shared agreement of deciding that we're going to work together, because when times get tough, it can be sometimes too much for one person to bear.
That's right, Mark. And you can feel like we have this little cohort that's been on this webcast tonight, and everyone was interested in some way in the relationship between profound spiritual practice, ongoing, sustained, and committed spiritual practice and meditation to health and healing. So whatever we inspired us to be interested in this, then we want to put it into practice as best we can. And we want to know that the more we put it into practice within reason, within our own means, we will be inspiring each other. So that's part of why we do come together in these ways. And maybe we can't all see each other, we don't all know who's on the line, but there is a cohort that's come together tonight who's interested in these things. And knowing that does, again, like you said, it gives courage when we find it tough. And that's part of what spiritual community, congregations, and sanghas have always been for.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mark.
You know, in such a modern world where where I grew up and I didn't understand all the benefit and appreciation of a spiritual community, for you to be living that is very meaningful and inspirational. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Rabab.
Hey, Lon. Hello.
By the way, I think this is going to be the last question.
Well, it's not really a question, Amy. I'm really thankful for everything you brought up. It's very inspiring. I like how you acknowledged, even if it's a psychological self, because a lot of people we see. Of course, us too, but a lot of people we see in my treatment room, you know, the psychological aspect is, is very much alive, and it's like Lonnie said, you know, it's sort of a prison, but it's there, is what you said. It's you know, sometimes we go through some things and we're going to have to work through them. Is that what my understanding was?
Right.
Great.
So,
okay, well, thank you, Rabab. Okay, and we are going to do one last call. Mr. Robert Burden, we see your hand raised.
And thank you, Amy, and thank you, Lonnie. It's been a very interesting conversation. I am one of those students in Lonnie's classes that probably doesn't ask enough questions, but I just wanted to say thank you, Amy. It was such a pleasure to hear someone that personifies many of the concepts that Lonnie is talks about and tries to get us to aspire to. And I'm just looking so much forward to learning with you and Jeff and more with Lonnie. So I wanted to take this opportunity to say that I appreciate it so much of this lecture tonight.
Great. Well, nice to meet you virtually, and thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. So this is wrapping it up, everybody, and Amy and I both loved having the opportunity to spend this time with you, and we appreciate you, your attendance and your participation. I'd like to just draw attention back to the fact that you'll be receiving an email shortly after this talk, pointing you to having the opportunity to participate in the meditation marathon, either by donating money or actually spending. You can spend an hour of time. You can do the whole marathon with us for 24 hours. Some of you are probably thinking, oh my God, I sit for 15 minutes and it's hell. Well, that's because you only sit for 15 minutes. If you sit for 20 minutes, the last five will probably be better. And some of you think, well, I couldn't possibly do more than an hour. But I can just say that I had meditated on and off for 25 years before something finally happened in a meditation, and I could never sit for 20 or 30 minutes without feeling terrible, and something happened, and I was immediately able to sit for 4 hours. So don't set any limits on yourself, and try to meditate with us. Pick an amount of time that seems a little beyond the comfort zone, and I think you'll be very happy with what happens. Anyway, we'll send you this email. And Amy, would you like to?
Yeah, I wanted to. First of all, there were a number of you who had questions that we didn't get to. So please post them on the discussion forum. Email them to Lonnie if you're not on his forum, and he can post them for you, and then you can view them. And I'll be up there every day this week answering questions or responding to thoughts and comments from this presentation.
Let me point out for those who don't know, that's on nourishingdestiny.com, nourishingdestiny.com, and that'll be in the email. So all the registration information will be in the email. The discussion group is free, and you can contemplate what we've said tonight, and if you want to interact with Amy, she'll be on for the next week, and you can post questions and engage in dialogue.
And please do support me. I have a team for the meditation marathon. It's called A Big Yes. That's the name of my team. And if you'd like to meditate, if you'd like to learn how to meditate, this is a really good opportunity. There will be meditation instructions. There will be some chants for contemplation or readings for contemplation before practice, which you can do during the meditation marathon or keep them in practice throughout the next year. I would really encourage you to do that. It's really a wonderful opportunity, and there will be people meditating this day all around the world. And if you join my team, you'll know that you'll be following through on the commitment to everything we talked about now of really cultivating our familiarity with these deeper dimensions. And then, of course, if you feel moved to support me in the fundraiser, I am committed to raising $26,000, $1,000 for each year that I've been practicing evolutionary enlightenment, mainly because it really does take time to cultivate depth and to help others cultivate that depth. So I'm committed to inspiring as many people as I can, you know, discover the depths of spirit and to discover how their own lives can transform and what they can become exemplars of. So we will email you, and I want to thank everyone for the wonderful questions and for your attentiveness tonight. And thank you, Lonnie, for the opportunity to speak with you and speak with so many of your students.
Okay. And thank you, Amy. And thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.